As children, we're taught the difference between the truth and a lie. But at one point or another, we've all stretched the truth to the proverbial snapping point. And sometimes, it snaps.
What you hear in the corporate media, and I will name them, BBC, Guardian, New York Times, etc., on Aleppo is also opposite of reality.
I think that what's happening is that we are slipping back into phases, namely authoritarian or monarchical phases.
Can you stay categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody...
Facts have become malleable, subordinate to feeling and opinion. Data is politicized, and more, truth is what you make it.
I see post-truth as meaning that people no longer have to take questions of evidence, fact, serious argumentation, and what it means to be an informed citizen seriously anymore.
We used to agree to disagree. Now we can't even agree on what we're talking about.
It's important to keep in mind that emotion and truth are not two different things. Emotion has to do with what we care about, and truths have to do with things that are the case. The two have to work together.
Our own age has even been dubbed the post-truth era. We're calling this episode The Truth About Post-Truth, and we begin with a story about the importance of telling the truth, one you probably already know. How, as a boy, George Washington hacked his father's cherry tree, and when confronted by his father, George fessed up and said, "I cannot tell a lie." Turns out that story, about telling the truth, was fake news. It was made up to give the audience what it wanted. Kind of like today.
Commercial media lit up like Vegas the day Donald Trump announced his presidential candidacy and said the following: "When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending the best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people," unquote. Trump's hate-mongering was perfect fodder for driving up TV ratings. Rather than presenting Trump's comments in the context of America's long legacy of racism and state violence, the mainstream media uncritically broadcast his remarks, initially as those of a fearless billionaire who has achieved such supreme success that he speaks his mind without concern for the consequences. My name is Henry Giroux, and I'm a professor at McMaster University.
Henry Giroux's latest book is called America at War with Itself.
I see post-truth as meaning that people no longer have to take questions of evidence, fact, serious argumentation, and what it means to be an informed citizen seriously anymore. I think that what post-truth is really a flight from any sense of ethical, political, and social responsibility. It's a way of basically looking at what people have to say so as to suggest that all that the distinction between an opinion and a fact, an informed argument and nonsense can somehow be treated equally.
And Henry, when you look at the world we're in now, what are the markers you see that indicate we've gone from where we were into a post-truth era?
Well, I think there's a long history of, particularly starting with the Bush, actually starting with Lyndon Johnson, in which governments basically engaged in lies in order to pursue particular kinds of policies. But I think that something happens after 9/11. What happens is that the nature of the lies become more serious. I mean, because there's Bush sort of in some way lying, not in some way, actually lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But then after that, it seems to me we move into a kind of different universe, a universe in which celebrity culture, the dumbing down of the culture, seems to take on a force unlike we've ever seen before. Corporations, as they consolidate power, sort of tap into the spectacle of entertainment, a spectacle of what I would call the culture of immediacy, a culture of utter sensations, one which not only dumbs down society in general, but sort of creates a sort of damaged relationship with memory in that it depoliticizes, infantilizes, and commodifies. And I think that in many ways, the overabundance of information, the way in which the internet has become a technology that for all of the productive things that it does, also in some way begins to undermine, with this overabundance of information coupled with a culture of speed, instantaneous time, and immediacy, thoughtfulness begins to go out the window.
Henry, is the post-truth era really all the media's fault?
No, it's not. It's not all the media's fault. And I think that as important as the media has been in many ways in substituting entertainment for the truth, I mean, there are other factors that we have to look at. I mean, first of all, you've got, since 9/11, a culture of fear that functions in such a way that it becomes a breeding ground for instant answers, for insecurity, and for a culture of cruelty. When people are fearful, there's a tendency to look for immediate answers because people basically have given up in some ways, given the dumbing down of the culture, have sort of given up on the long kinds of analysis that are necessary to understand complex problems. Climate change is a complex problem. You know, it isn't something just produced by China. When we talk about inequality in North America, Canada, the United States, these are complex problems. But when you have a culture so dumbed down, particularly by celebrity culture, an entertainment media that creates what I call a culture of illusions, or a market-driven society that elevates self-interest and privatization and unchecked individualism over any sense of a sense of shared responsibility, then people turn inward. And there's a movement away from the world in ways that would demand thoughtfulness, analysis, and social engagement. And I think in some ways, the other side of this is you have an educational system that has gone insane. I mean, when we talk about educating kids in ways which means teaching to the test, when we talk about education being modeled after prisons, when we talk about kids basically learning to be obedient rather than to have their imaginations stretched, what you have here is you have the death of the imagination. You have the death of any kind of civic culture. You have the erosion of any sense of shared responsibility. You have long flights from public service, the blurring of distinctions between facts and fiction. And so language begins to succumb to an aesthetics of vulgarity, a style that sort of thrives on what I would call, you know, the depravity of the spectacle of violence, entertainment that's mindless. And I think that all of these kinds of issues have come together to create the perfect storm in which people no longer want to think. People want to be entertained. People no longer trust the media because they see the media as just another adjunct of the entertainment system.
We've entered definitely this post-truth world. That's what people are talking about. I want to know, though, what's the difference between post-truth and just plain lying?
I don't like the term post-truth, and I'm with you. I think it covers up more than it reveals. Post-truth, what does that mean? I mean, let's call a lie a lie. I mean, it makes a lot more sense to me to say, look, that person's lying, rather than to wrap it in some kind of abstraction, which seems to say we're beyond it. We're not beyond the truth. The truth always matters. And I think the truth becomes a standard, evidence becomes a standard, facts become a standard by which we begin to engage in forms of communication in which we actually believe that words matter, that sentences matter. That will no longer accept the fact that when lies become normalized, language evaporates. Language doesn't have any meaning. Traditional sources of information begin to disappear. When you can't make a distinction between, it seems to me, the truth, facts, evidence, informed judgments, and stupid, silly opinions, that's about the breakdown of a democracy, because a democracy cannot exist without informed citizenship. We're not talking about post-truth. We're talking about the rise of civic illiteracy, and that's a very different issue. When a country no longer takes civic literacy seriously, when people can engage in politics, they can look to evidence, they can research, they can think by making connections. If that doesn't happen, then what you find yourself in is a period, and you can call it anything you want, but lies all of a sudden now are connected to forms of lawlessness in which anything can be said and anything can be done. That's about the collapse of the ethical imagination. Treated seriously, celebrity culture provides the architectural framing for an authoritarian culture by celebrating a deadening form of self-interest, narcissism, and civic illiteracy.
Let's talk about something you said that I think is really interesting. That is the the fact that celebrity culture fosters what is called, you call, civic illiteracy. Tell us how that happens.
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, I let's begin with the assumption that I think is right, and that is celebrity culture in American society, in the United States in particular, confers a great deal of authority. And it seems to me that it results in a kind of dumbing down of the culture unlike anything we have seen in a long time. I mean, it's celebrity culture, I think, in some way has such a damaged relationship to memory. I mean, it collapses the distinction between frivolous and serious ideas. It infantilizes, commodifies. It's a culture of commodification. It's absolutely saturated in what I call a culture of self-promotion and absorption. And I think that for that culture to now be one of the primary educational forces in society, that to me spells something horrendous. I call celebrity culture a disimagination machine because I think it kills the imagination. I think it fills people with nonsense. You know, it collapses people into positions where they're screaming because they might win something, or they think that democracy is voting for the best singer. They think that's what participation is all about. I mean, I think it's very dangerous, and I think it's had an enormously detrimental effect upon the culture itself.
Henry, you and I both, in some sense, come from the same place, and that is a culture in which education is valued, where the kinds of discussions that we're engaged in right now are considered important, crucial, really, and where questions are always on the table and meant to be. One question, you know, it's always been around, what is the nature of truth? And people have argued about it. It hasn't been some kind of absolute universal, but it is an absolute value. Truth is a value. That's not true anymore.
No, I think that's very smart. I mean, because it raises the question, what do you value in a democracy? And if you don't value the truth, then you don't live in a democracy and you won't live in one. If you don't value education in ways that suggest it's not just simply training or cheap entertainment or about the endless spectacle of violence, then you're not going to live in a democracy. I mean, I think that we have found ourselves for the first time, the American public has found itself for the first time in which it engaged in an election which really wasn't about simply Trump or Clinton. It was about whether you want to live in a democracy or not. And I think a lot of people who believe that capitalism and democracy are the same said, capitalism failed for me, so I don't care about democracy. And so it seems to me as this flight from all these institutions, civic institutions, began because they were defunded, downgraded, pathologized, and disdained, all of a sudden a new kind of worldview emerges, which is very dangerous, in which everything is relative and anything can be said and nothing matters. Under neoliberalism, time presents itself as a form of tyranny, an unquestioned necessity, and in speeding up the flows of work, leisure, and knowledge in everyday life, it spawns a new kind of violence in which the flow of money replaces the flow of thoughtfulness, atomization replaces a notion of shared solidarity, spectacle undermines historical memory, privatization seeks to erase all notions of the public good, and preventable precarity replaces any sense of security and long-term planning.
You say that time becomes a kind of a tyrant. How so?
I think that in many ways, time has been colonized to a kind of business logic in which it becomes an assault on the ability to make connections. You know, we're stuck in a pace that's so fast, so overwhelming. You know, this emphasis on, for instance, short-term investments, this emphasis on the assumption that, you know, we have to just keep going and work endlessly in order to do something with our lives, the notion that we don't have time to contemplate, the notion that we don't have time to be thoughtful, you know, the notion that in some way we can speak, that the only matter that really seems to have any value around time is accelerating it. And I think that in that case, what often happens is that time becomes a deprivation rather than a luxury. Time becomes a burden. So I think this refiguring of time and memory and justice and what it means to create public spaces, spaces where time becomes a luxury rather than a burden, is really about the crisis of politics and democracy.
And the underlying topic today is, in fact, truth, whether it's post-truth or variable truth or relative truth, all these kinds of things. Is shared truth endangered now? Is it even possible? Maybe it's extinct.
No democracy can exist without a sense of shared citizenship, without a sense of shared responsibilities, and without a shared understanding of what matters. I think that when we talk about the eclipse of truth and reason and thoughtfulness, and we don't recognize what the and we refuse to recognize that politics has now been emptied out into theater, and that measured arguments don't matter anymore, and that, you know, we in some way create a pseudo world in which justice becomes as irrelevant as injustice, then I think something terrible begins to happen. I think that we see not just simply a crisis of intellect, a crisis of justice, a crisis of memory, but I think that basically we see an incredibly severe crisis of democracy. What's at stake here is democracy, not just the question of the truth, not just the question of lies, not just the question of the concentration of the media in relatively few hands. What's at stake is really serious, because if we don't address this, and considering that we're at the tipping point, then we're going to lose that democracy. Democracies are never guaranteed. They have to be fought for.
You're listening to Ideas and to an episode we're calling The Truth About Post-Truth.
The distinctive danger of propaganda in a liberal democracy is that it goes unnoticed. It is hard to think of a better way to exhibit this distinctive danger than by reflection on the fact that philosophy professors in liberal democratic societies assume that there is a distinctive and easily identifiable class of words, the function of which is to decrease reasonableness, which have this effect wherever they occur in a sentence. My name is Jason Stanley. I'm the Jacob Urofsky Professor of Philosophy at Yale University.
Jason Stanley's most recent book is called How Propaganda Works.
As I see it, the talk of post-truth suggests that history goes in a progression and we are now entering a novel phase, a post-truth phase.
What are the markers that tell us that we're moving into that stage?
Well, I have some problem with the vocabulary of post-truth because I disagree with that description of what's occurring. So I think that what's happening is that we are slipping back into phases, namely authoritarian or monarchical phases. And democracy, truth phases, are very infrequent in history. They're very infrequent in history, and they're very infrequent at any time in history across the globe. I think post-truth or pre-truth or non-truth societies are the norm. And truth societies, societies governed by respect for truth, are the exception.
What unnoticed bits of propaganda have you noticed the most?
The propaganda of liberal democracies is that there is no propaganda. But I think that we've shifted into a distinct phase very recently with our recent election. I think that before our election, there's always been propaganda in liberal democracies. Politicians take advantage of the fact that people believe there is no propaganda. But if they're caught, there's often punishment. Now, what's happened most recently in our most recent election is that when politicians were caught issuing falsehoods, there was no punishment whatsoever. In fact, they were almost rewarded for it. And the media has yet to catch up with that shift in the public culture.
Are there any other differences between what we might call totalitarian propaganda and the kind of propaganda that you're seeing now in the United States? I mean, you're saying that part of liberal democracy propaganda is that there's no propaganda. Are there any other differences, though?
Well, I think that we've shifted into an authoritarian propaganda moment in the United States in our previous elections. So I think that we've shifted into a phase where, although there's no evidence that the president-elect has an anti-democratic ideology, the strategy he has employed in his political campaign has been authoritarian in nature. both the rallies and the chanting at the rallies. I could go into more detail on that, as well as the redefining of reality.
I'm intrigued because you said that this is not a new phenomenon. This is something that has historical roots, indeed goes back a long, long time. And I want to go back a bit and let's discuss the original messages that were sent out from the church, as I understand it, about people telling untruths. And that was what propaganda was. It was in a sense something that was trying to force pagans to be more Christian.
Yes, of course, the church was thought of itself as delivering the truth, and propaganda, the word, comes from the Catholic Church, and the idea was to instill, to spread the doctrine of the church. So propaganda, the term, didn't carry negative connotations until the 20th century, until authoritarian regimes such as Nazi Germany, Soviet Union, the brutal communist dictatorships of Eastern Europe, and Cuba, North Korea. So propaganda acquired pejorative connotations then, and it acquired pejorative connotations in liberal democratic regimes after World War I. Walter Lippmann was the editor of the New Republic during World War I, and used propaganda to get Americans very militarized and behind the World War I effort. And then after the war, Lippmann became extremely concerned about the power of propaganda, the power of these falsehoods. And though propaganda doesn't need to be false, but he became concerned about what he himself did, and then he wrote about its dangers. And propaganda in wartime always emerges. We saw that in the IRA. It's no accident that this election season follows so closely upon a major war, the 2003 Iraq War, in which we had a large amount of bending of reality for policy goals.
How have things changed more recently? And that means, I guess, in the context of the Trump election. I mean, what is the relationship now between propaganda and not truth, but post-truth?
Well, now I think, so I need to back up and explain a little bit about what a liberal democratic society is to get at post-truth. I mean, a liberal democratic society is one that values liberty and equal respect. Because if you value liberty, you value your fellow citizens' liberty. You want them all to have liberty. So you need to give them equal respect so they can tell you when their liberty is being impinged upon. And truth is the guarantee for equal respect. Because if you value truth, then you have to listen to those with, if you want to give those with less power equal respect, then, you know, you have to listen to them. You have to make sure that your views about them aren't false. So truth is the sort of leveler between those with less power and those with more power that ensures that you're not impinging on the autonomy of those with less power. So in an authoritarian society, by contrast, in a monarchy, for instance, almost all human societies, especially in the West, were monarchies until recently. So certainly in the West, in Western Europe. So in monarchies, the main principle is not truth, but the main principle is power. And what you're doing when you're in an authoritarian society, people learn to respect power. And so in an authoritarian society, an authoritarian leader will demonstrate their power by defining reality. So they will be free, they will feel free to define reality so it accords with the ideology that they want you to have.
They've got a monopoly on truth.
They have a monopoly on truth. That's exactly right. And people don't punish them for saying false things because they've shifted their cultural norms to power. They admire power now. And when President-elect Trump speaks of the movement, I fear he's speaking of a movement of people who respect him as the one with a monopoly on truth, who view power and his power and his exhibition of power as what should be praised and exalted.
You're listening to Ideas on SiriusXM, CBC Radio 1, and cbc.ca/ideas. I'm Paul Kennedy with an episode we're calling The Truth About Post-Truth. The post-truth era in popular culture may well be the offspring of post-structuralist and post-modern thinking within the academy. If what we call the truth is ultimately a function of perspective, then what prevails is just the product of power. As Friedrich Nietzsche once said, a mobile army of metaphors, illusions about which one has forgotten that this is what they are. My truth, your truth, do-it-yourself truth. Some believe we're in danger of pulling the epistemological rug out from under our own feet. Others believe we've already done that.
I want to get a clearer understanding, though, of what's different about now. And I guess, you know, the question is, you say that propaganda's been around for a long time, and I certainly buy into that as a suggestion, but I'm wondering if propaganda, because it's been around a long time, it isn't very, very unique or different. That, you know, every argument that anyone has ever made, even in our current situation, can be called propaganda.
I think when you keep on referring to our current situation, I'm reminded of the strong difference between Canadian political culture and current U.S. political culture.
Okay.
I think it's very important to distinguish propaganda from cherry-picking facts, for example, or giving an argument from a perspective, because then every argument is propaganda.
Right.
So I criticize the classical definition of propaganda as biased arguments, because every time you give an argument, you're highlighting certain facts over others. But that's different from giving an argument that has premises that are false. I may say, look, this population commits lots of crimes. And then you look and you see that statistically that population does commit lots of crimes. And I may use that in an argument to that we should have harsher punitive measures against them. But then you could respond by making a true claim that the population is extremely poor and has many less resources than other citizens. And this is an explanation of why they commit crimes, and therefore a punitive response is not required. We should rather make up the inequalities. So that's an argument in a liberal democratic society where one party gives an argument for punitive measures with a true premise, and the other person responds by saying, sure, your premise is true, but you've left some crucial facts out. So there you've got respect for facts, you've got biased arguments, but all arguments are given from a perspective because we don't have infinite time. We can't consider every possibility, we can't consider everything because we only live a certain number, 80 years if we're lucky. So we need to back off a definition of propaganda that is characterized in terms of bias or such like. So I give a narrower definition of propaganda. So I characterize one kind of propaganda as the use of political ideals against themselves. And the other kind of propaganda I characterize is the kind you find in authoritarian societies where you try to overwhelm the use of rationality and reason with emotions detached from ideas. So you try to heighten fear. You try to heighten anger, and to such a degree where people can't evaluate arguments anymore. They're just overwhelmed.
I wonder what we're supposed to do, though, in that kind of context. I mean, if we can't use truth or we can't use reason, rationality as the litmus paper by which we test all of these things, what are we left with? Do we shout louder than the people we're trying to defeat and thereby establish our point of view?
I do not think so. I think we double down on liberal democratic norms. And I think you see President Obama doing that. he's stepping down. He's not challenging anything. He has respect for the president-elect. And the president-elect has shown some respect for President Obama. So I think it's very important to adhere to liberal democratic norms. We must remember that liberal democracy is a system that was considered impossible for thousands of years. And it could be that liberal democracy has had its moment, and the liberal democratic order is collapsing, and we are joining the 90% of the world that lives under authoritarianism. Athenian democracy only lasted for a few hundred years. But I think we cannot shout louder. We must simply double down on liberal democratic norms. We must demand truth, that our politicians speak the truth. We must denounce them when they issue falsehoods. But we must not engage in the propaganda in the kind of fear-mongering and scaremongering and hate-mongering that confronts those of us who are deeply wedded to freedom.
It puts us into a difficult, for sure, maybe even almost impossible situation, though, that you're trying to have a conversation with somebody about something, not an easy topic, something like climate change or, racial equality, tolerance. And as you start the conversation, you realize that you don't even have the same vocabulary, that there's very little agreement about what truth is, what reality is. And how do you have a conversation in that context?
Yeah, this happened to me once in a debate. I was talking to someone and they weren't making any sense. They were someone who was very smart, and they were saying things that I knew went against their own published views and their own considered views. And then afterwards I asked them, well, what was going on? And they said to me, oh, Jason, haven't you been in a war zone? And I said, no, I've never been in a war zone. And this person had. And I said, in a war zone, you say things to win. There's no rules. You just win. And we were in a war zone because it was politics. And I responded by saying, that's not my conception of politics. So it's very tricky. It's not an accident that liberal democracy has been so tenuous, fragile, and has not been the dominant system across the globe. It's unusual to have periods in human history where there are flourishing liberal democracies. There is no problem in totalitarian societies recognizing something as propaganda. Claims that are propaganda are those that emerge from the Ministry of Propaganda. The problem in totalitarian societies lies in figuring out which pieces of propaganda are to be taken seriously. It is only natural in liberal democratic societies to take at least the news media seriously. The problem in democratic societies lies in figuring out which apparently non-propagandistic claims are in fact propaganda.
Jason, on my good days, I'm with you 1,000%. On my less optimistic days, I suppose, I sometimes begin to worry that we are all worker ants, and we're in this situation that really sounds inhumane.
No one should be running for president of the United States saying that they're a good businessman, because a business is not run like a democracy. In a democracy, everyone rules. And that's going to mean that there are inefficiencies, because efficiency is a virtue, but it's not a democratic virtue. Efficiency is not a democratic virtue. Autonomy is a democratic virtue. And when people do what they want to do, often they'll do things that, are not the most efficient, don't make sense, don't make sense to others, don't make society run as efficiently as possible. But freedom and efficiency are often at odds. And a business is run to minimize freedom and maximize efficiency. So you don't want your president to be a business person. You want them to be someone who is devoted to freedom and equality. You want them to be another one of us, not the CEO.
Where are we now? We're talking about democracy. We're talking about truth. Are both of them either on the way to extinction or maybe already there?
I don't know. It's a crisis moment across the West. We have nationalist parties all over the Western Europe. National Front in France, UKIP in the UK. And what is nationalism? Nationalism is the view that my tribe has its own truth. And what is truth? What is equality? Those are things that break down barriers between nations, break down barriers between identities. Truth is an equalizer. So when you have nationalism, you have movements that do not respect truth explicitly. And nationalism has been the rule of the day in human history. And democracy, equality, freedom, and truth have been the exceptions. If we start adopting anti-democratic tactics, then we have no ground to stand on.
Plato, like many of today's progressives, conceived of the truth in absolute terms. He imagined that there was a world of forms, of perfect ideals, including the good and the true, against which we should measure our fallen, messy reality. Where Plato believed that philosopher kings were justified in advancing the, as he put it, noble lie, Nietzsche thought that we were mostly unaware of our lies, unable to distinguish them from interpretations and our waking dreams about the reality of the world. Nietzsche wanted philosophy to recognize that we never have been able and never will be able to get wholesale agreement on the truth. My name is Kathleen Higgins, and I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin.
Kathleen Higgins' article, The Unlikely Political Wisdom of Friedrich Nietzsche, appeared in the Breakthrough Journal.
As I see it, post-truth has to do with a political climate in which people don't really care that much about whether or not what's told them is true or not, and don't really care whether or not decisions are made on the basis of things that aren't, in fact, the case. Post-truth, as often is understood as involving people's emotions more than their critical ability to make distinctions. And I think that might be true, but it's important to keep in mind that emotion and truth are not two different things. Emotion has to do with what we care about, and truths have to do with things that are the case. The two have to work together. What truths we choose to act on are matters of emotion. And I think that it would be a real mistake for those who care about the truth to stress that people ought to pay less attention to their emotions. I think they ought to pay attention to their emotions very much, but emotions that are informed by facts that have been critically evaluated and interpreted.
So instead we sort of walk in assuming that we know what we should take seriously and it happens to agree with what we think.
That, and also if there's something newsworthy, if it's repeated over and over again, and many people seem to take it seriously, we're happy to assimilate that to views we already have.
Kathleen, I'm going to take a deep breath and sort of stand back and ask a question in a rather blunt fashion, almost. And that is, you know, what's the difference then between what we're thinking of now as post-truth and, well, just plain old-fashioned lying?
Well, old-fashioned lying, I think, is an effort to conceal something that one knows to be true from someone else. One can take that in a negative direction, of course. I mean, what one knows to be true might be, I know that I don't know this, but I'm going to purport that I do. But there's a kind of deliberation and a deliberate effort to pull the wool over someone's eyes, usually about something very particular. The post-truth era, I think, involves more an effort to encourage people not to pay too much attention to the facts or to simply go along with an outright lie. For instance, when someone asserts that you did say that and you deny it, that can be an outright lie. But to kind of expect people to go along with the wave of whatever one is currently asserting, even if there are contradictions, a liar in the traditional sense is going to go out of the way, their way not to enable people to recognize, wait a minute, that contradicts something you said just a little while ago. That's one of the reasons why the web of lies becomes hard to maintain. If it is genuinely a post-truth era, then it's not so hard to maintain because you expect people to forget as quickly as possible what you said or to take that as one more instance of saying something that you're not really all that committed to in the first place.
What then is truth? A mobile army of metaphors, metonyms, and anthropomorphisms, in short, a sum of human relations which have been enhanced, transposed, and embellished, poetically and rhetorically, and which after long use seem firm, canonical, and obligatory to a people. Truths are illusions about which one has forgotten that is what they are. Metaphors which are worn out and without sensuous power. Coins which have lost their pictures and now matter only as metal, no longer as coins.
Okay, I want to switch now to Nietzsche. And in your writings, you actually spend a lot of time with Friedrich Nietzsche, 19th century German philosopher, who happens to be one of my favorite philosophers. Talk about Nietzsche in the context of this post-truth society. Why do you talk about him?
Well, I talk about him because he has a lot of complicated things to say about the truth, some of which, at least on the surface, might seem to encourage a post-truth era. For instance, he points out that people oftentimes assert things and try to cloak them in a kind of a mantle of truth, when in fact what they're saying is motivated by basic power motivations. And his view is that we shouldn't be surprised at that, that people always try to present things in a way that is going to enhance their own power. Now, I should quickly add that his sense of power is not necessarily political power or military power or most of the things that we view as power. They can be very small scale power plays, for instance, in a relationship, you know, tit for tat. You didn't help me with this, I'm not going to help you. That sort of thing is as much a demonstration of desire for power as a desire to take over the world. But at the same time, he thinks one of the problems we have with respect to what truth amounts to is we often don't notice how much we ourselves are motivated by power. So we tend to think of what we take to be true as something that is completely innocent and unmotivated in any respect, whereas what other people say, particularly when it seems to leave out some dimensions that we take to be important, that those things are just outright lies. So I think he's an important person to look at because his connection of power with the truth is a really important one to keep in mind. And I think also the idea that a lot of times we're unaware of the extent to which our own motivations color what it is that we think is going on or how we interpret things. A lot of times we don't really take what we're saying to be an interpretation at all. We take that to simply be the fact of the matter, whereas the way other people spin it, well, in that case, they've spun it. I think he raises a lot of questions that we need to consider. For example, how does one come to realize the extent to which we're motivated by our own efforts to maintain a certain amount of control of our situation? That I think, is something we ought to be concerned with, too.
At the basis of it all, I think, come to the sort of frightening reality that the post-truth world is a world of ultimate egotism. You're living literally in your own world.
Well, I think that is part of the problem, part of what Nietzsche diagnoses, that unless we take in perspectives from other people, then we are, in a sense, cut off from the rest of the world. And, I mean, it's egotistical, but it's also perhaps dangerous to us ourselves because we do, in some sense, deal with and operate in the real world. Our post-truth society was uncannily predicted by one of the great philosophers of the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche. Observing the rise of modern societies in Europe, Nietzsche saw religious authority on the decline and concluded that the era of a unified belief system had come to an end. The idea both excited and troubled him. It excited him that Judeo-Christian religion was on the decline, since he considered it a version of herd morality that kept creative people from realizing their true potential. But it troubled him because he feared that democracy was herd morality in new clothing.
That phrase that Nietzsche used there, that democracy was the herd morality, but in new clothing, it's a frightening, haunting kind of phrase. Do you think that we're in a herd morality age now?
Well, there is that danger. Part of the problem, of course, is that it isn't absolutely everybody in the world who is entitled to wear the mantle of a group of people. I mean, in a democracy, you can't literally have everyone voting on every issue. We have to have representation. And insofar as we figure out who's going to be the representative, it's the majority that dictates that. There are techniques like the Electoral College that complicate that a bit. But basically, the majority rules. And the question is, well, how do you actually obtain a majority? Oftentimes, it's a matter of herding people into some degree of consensus, sometimes an unwitting consensus that lead them to accept one representative rather than another. So there's always going to be a little bit of this in democracy to begin with. And if it becomes the case that people are largely being herded without exercising any critical questioning over what's being asserted, I think it makes them a lot easier to herd.
How unique is the time that we're living in? This obsession we have with truth and whether we all see the same truth or not being able to see the same truth, is that unprecedented? I mean, have there been times before this, historically, when civilization or society faced these same kind of issues?
Well, I suppose in the Enlightenment, this was perhaps not in newspapers so much, but in sort of more intellectual circles, something that was seriously discussed, because the question was being raised, well, how do you actually ensure that people, especially in a context where increasingly cosmopolitan situations occur, where people from different backgrounds come together, how do you adjudicate among the points of view that people have? And in the Enlightenment, a lot of intellectuals argued for reason as being the way forward, because reason should be something that people ought to be able to recognize the force of. And so in some ways, our post-truth discussion is perhaps a reaction against that way of looking at what the truth is.
Well, people have always talked about the truth, and it hasn't always been agreed that there is one truth. I mean, it's been debated, contested, argued what the truth might be. But I think we are in a kind of new situation now. People are talking not so much about the nature of it, but the value of it. They don't care.
I think maybe part of the issue is that truth and information are taken to be more or less synonymous. And I think that the idea that information, which is something that you can amass indefinitely, way beyond the extent to which anybody could possibly assimilate it, that is equivalent to truth, makes people think, well, maybe truth isn't really all that important. I can't cope with all this information, and why should I? My life is too short. I think it's important for those of us who do care about the truth to somehow wrest truth away from the image of just this mountain of information that no one can seriously master, and recognize that truth is something else. It's not just knowing all the facts. It's a matter of being able to evaluate what's being presented to you and figuring out whether or not those things that you're being told actually do square with what you know of reality or what one can find through informed sources about the nature of reality.
Why do you think that the ability to distinguish, to evaluate that we've been talking about, why has that sort of fallen into disrepute?
I think it's fallen into disrepute because of despair over the amount of information one would need to be on top of in order to be completely confident of everything that one thinks. And I think maybe the antidote to this would be to recognize that intellectual humility is a good stance, that one shouldn't be content that absolutely everything that you think is correct, but instead one should question. I think a lot of times people take questioning to be a sign of a weak personality, but actually I think particularly in this context, it's a sign of a kind of strength.
You say that I'm quoting you here, Nietzsche leaves us with a notion of objectivity as multiple, fractured, partial, and contingent. So he leaves us with that. Where does that leave us?
Well, he leaves us with that. But what he means by that is one ought to try as hard as one can to figure out how things look from other perspectives besides one's own. In fact, at one point he talks about objectivity as a matter of putting on as many different perspectives as possible, and what one gets from that pooled point of view or the larger vision of the situation one has when one's taken these various perspectives, his claim is that is objectivity. What that means is it's not objective in an absolute sense, but in a sense that moves in the direction of convergence. So he's challenged a certain kind of notion of truth as something that one can determine in absolute terms. But that doesn't mean that we're without any kind of objectivity. At certain points in time, just a lack of ways in which people could get information made it difficult for them to have the wherewithal to evaluate claims. So I think in those days, it was a lot easier to prevent people from having awareness of certain kinds of things. Now, I think there are lots of different sources that people can get information from that they might use as evidence for one belief or another. But how to put it all together, that's the real challenge. And sometimes easy answers or easy formula for doing that look pretty appealing. So I think the problem is, how in our era do we resist that temptation to just go along with a way that seems to put everything together very neatly?
On Ideas, you've been listening to The Truth About Post-Truth. This episode was produced by Nahid Mustafa. Our guests were Henry Giroux, professor of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, and Kathleen Higgins, professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. For more about them and what post-truth may mean to us, please visit our website at cbc.ca/ideas. While there, you can, of course, always download our podcast. Liz Nagy is the associate producer of Ideas. Technical production, Dave Field. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.